Chapter 13. Containing a full account of the installation of Mr. Pecksniff's new pupil into the bosom of Mr. Pecksniff's family, with all the festivities held on that occasion, and the great enjoyment of Mr. Pinch, the best of architects and land surveyors, kept a horse, in whom the enemies already mentioned more than once in these pages pretended to detect a fanciful resemblance to his master. Not in his outward person, for he was a raw-boned, haggard horse, always on a much shorter allowance of corn than Mr. Pecksniff, but in his moral character, wherein, said they, he was full of promise, but of no performance. He was always in a manner, going to go, and never going. When at his slowest rate of travelling he would sometimes lift up his leg so high, and display such mighty action, that it was difficult to believe he was doing less than 14 miles an hour, and he was forever so perfectly satisfied with his own speed, and so little disconcerted by opportunities of comparing himself with the fastest trotters, that the illusion was the more difficult of resistance. He was a kind of animal who infused into the breasts of strangers a lively sense of hope, and possessed all those who knew him better with a grim despair. In what respect, having these points of character, he might be fairly likened to his master, that good man's slanderers only can explain. But it is a melancholy truth, and a deplorable instance of the uncharitableness of the world, that they made the comparison. In this horse, and the hooded vehicle, whatever its proper name might be, to which he was usually harnessed, it was more like a gig with a tumor than anything else all Mr. Pinch's thoughts and wishes centered. One bright frosty morning, for with this gallant equipage he was about to drive to Salisbury alone, there to meet with the new pupil, and thence to bring him home in triumph. Blessings on thy simple heart, Tom Pinch, how proudly dost thou button up that scanty coat, called by a sad misnomer, for these many years, a great one, and how thoroughly, as with thy cheerful voice thou pleasantly adjurest Sam the hostler not to let him go yet, apostrophe dost thou believe that quadruped desires to go, and would go if he might. Who could repress a smile of love for thee, Tom Pinch, and not in jest at thy expense, for thou art poor enough already, heaven knows, to think that such a holiday as lies before thee should awaken that quick flow and hurry of the spirits, in which thou settest down again, almost untasted, on the kitchen windowsill, that great white mug, put by thy own hands, last night, that breakfast might not hold thee late, and layest yonder crust upon the seat beside thee, to be eaten on the road, when thou art calmer in thy high rejoicing, who, as thou drivest off, a happy man, and noddest with a grateful lovingness to Pecksniff in his nightcap at his chamber window, would not cry, heaven speed thee, Tom, and send that thou wert going off forever to some quiet home, where thou mightst live at peace, and sorrow should not touch thee. Apostrophe, apostrophe, what better time for driving, riding, walking, moving through the air by any means, than a fresh, frosty morning, when hope runs cheerily through the veins with the brisk blood, and tingles in the frame from head to foot. This was the glad commencement of a bracing day in early winter, such as may put the languid summer season, speaking of it when it can't be had, to the blush, and shame the spring for being sometimes cold by halves. The sheep bells rang as clearly in the vigorous air, as if they felt its wholesome influence like living creatures. The trees, in lieu of leaves or blossoms, shed upon the ground a frosty rime that sparkled as it fell, and might have been the dust of diamonds. So it was to Tom. From cottage chimneys, smoke went streaming up high, high, as if the earth had lost its grossness, being so fair, and must not be oppressed by heavy vapor. The crust of ice on the else rippling brook was so transparent, and so thin in texture, that the lively water might of its own free will have stopped in Tom's glad mind that had to look upon the lovely morning. And lest the sun should break this charm too eagerly, there moved between him and the ground, a mist like that which waits upon the moon on summer nights, the very same to Tom, and wooed him to dissolve it gently. Tom Pinch went on, not fast, but with a sense of rapid motion, which did just as well, and as he went, all kinds of things occurred to keep him happy. Thus when he came within sight of the turnpike, and was a long way off, he saw the tollman's wife, who at that moment checked a wagon, run back into the little house again like mad, to say she knew that Mr. Pinch was coming up. And she was right, for when he drew within hail of the gate, forth rushed the tollman's children, shrieking in tiny chorus, "Mr. Pinch!" To Tom's intense delight. The very tollman, though an ugly chap in general, and one whom folks were rather shy of handling, came out himself to take the toll, and give him rough good morning, and that with all this, and a glimpse of the family breakfast on a little round table before the fire, the crust Tom Pinch had brought away with him acquired as rich a flavor, as though it had been cut from a fairy loaf. But there was more than this. It was not only the married people, and the children who gave Tom Pinch a welcome as he passed. No, no. Sparkling eyes and snowy breasts came hurriedly to many an upper casement as he clattered by, and gave him back his greeting. Not stinted either, but sevenfold, good measure. They were all merry. They all laughed. And some of the wickedest among them even kissed their hands as Tom looked back. For who minded poor Mr. Pinch? There was no harm in him. And now the morning grew so fair, and all things were so wide awake and gay, that the sun seeming, to say Tom had no doubt he said I can't stand it any longer, I must have a look, streamed out in radiant majesty. The mist, too shy and gentle for such lusty company, fled off, quite scared, before it, and as it swept away, the hills and mounds and distant pasture lands, teeming with placid sheep and noisy crows, came out as bright as though they were unrolled brand new for the occasion. In compliment to which discovery, the brook stood still no longer, but ran briskly off to bear the tidings to the water mill, 3 miles away. Mr. Pinch was jogging along, full of pleasant thoughts and cheerful influences, when he saw, upon the path before him, going in the same direction with himself, a traveler on foot, who walked with a light quick step, and sang as he went for certain in a very loud voice, but not unmusically. He was a young fellow, of some 25 or 26 perhaps, and was dressed in such a free and fly-away fashion that the long ends of his loose red neckcloth were streaming out behind him quite as often as before, and the bunch of bright winter berries in the buttonhole of his velveteen coat was as visible to Mr. Pinch's rearward observation as if he had worn that garment wrong side foremost. He continued to sing with so much energy that he did not hear the sound of wheels until it was close behind him, when he turned a whimsical face and a very merry pair of blue eyes on Mr. Pinch, and checked himself directly. "Why, Mark," said Tom Pinch, stopping, "who'd have thought of seeing you here? Well, this is surprising." Mark touched his hat, and said, with a very sudden decrease of vivacity, that he was going to Salisbury. "And how spruce you are too!" said Mr. Pinch, surveying him with great pleasure. "Really, I didn't think you were half such a tight-made fellow, Mark." "Thank ye, Mr. Pinch. Pretty well for that, I believe. It's not my fault, you know. With regard to being spruce, sir, that's where it is, you see." And here he looked particularly gloomy. "Where what is?" Mr. Pinch demanded. "Where the aggravation of it is. Any man may be in good spirits and good temper when he's well dressed. There ain't much credit in that. If I was very ragged and very jolly, then I should begin to feel I had gained a point, Mr. Pinch. So you were singing just now, to bear up, as it were, against being well-dressed, eh, Mark?" said Pinch. "Your conversation's always equal to print, sir," rejoined Mark, with a broad grin. "That was it. Cried Pinch, "you are the strangest young man, Mark, I ever knew in my life. I always thought so. But now I am quite certain of it. I am going to Salisbury too. Will you get in? I shall be very glad of your company. Apostrophe, the young fellow made his acknowledgments, and accepted the offer, stepping into the carriage directly, and seating himself on the very edge of the seat with his body half out of it, to express his being there on sufferance, and by the politeness of Mr. Pinch. As they went along, the conversation proceeded after this manner. I more than half believed, just now, seeing you so very smart, apostrophe said Pinch, that you must be going to be married, Mark. Apostrophe, well, sir, I've thought of that too, apostrophe he replied. There might be some credit in being jolly with a wife, especially if the children had the measles and that, and was very fractious indeed. But I'm amost afraid to try it. I don't see my way clear. Apostrophe, you're not very fond of anybody, perhaps? Apostrophe, said Pinch. Not particular, sir, I think. Apostrophe, but the way would be, you know, Mark, according to your views of things, apostrophe said Mr. Pinch, to marry somebody you didn't like, and who was very disagreeable. Apostrophe, so it would, sir. But that might be carrying out a principle a little too far, mightn't it? Apostrophe, perhaps it might, apostrophe said Mr. Pinch. At which they both laughed gaily. Lord bless you, sir, apostrophe said Mark, you don't half know me, though. I don't believe there ever was a man as could come out so strong under circumstances that would make other men miserable, as I could, if I could only get a chance. But I can't get a chance. It's my opinion that nobody never will know half of what's in me, unless something very unexpected turns up. And I don't see any prospect of that. I'm a going to leave the dragon, sir. Apostrophe, going to leave the dragon. Apostrophe, cried Mr. Pinch, looking at him with great astonishment. Why, Mark, you take my breath away. Apostrophe, yes, sir, apostrophe he rejoined, looking straight before him, and a long way off, as men do sometimes when they cogitate profoundly. What's the use of my stopping at the Dragon? It ain't at all the sort of place for me. When I left London, I'm a Kentish man by birth, though, and took that situation here, I quite made up my mind that it was the dullest little out-of-the-way corner in England, and that there would be some credit in being jolly under such circumstances. But, Lord, there's no dullness at the Dragon. Skittles, cricket, quoits, ninepins, comic songs, choruses, company round the chimney corner every winter's evening. Any man could be jolly at the Dragon. There's no credit in that. Apostrophe, but if common report be true for once, Mark, as I think it is, being able to confirm it by what I know myself, apostrophe said Mr. Pinch, you are the cause of half this merriment, and set it going. Apostrophe, there may be something in that too, sir, apostrophe answered Mark. But that's no consolation. Apostrophe, well, apostrophe said Mr. Pinch, after a short silence, his usually subdued tone being even now more subdued than ever. I can hardly think enough of what you tell me. Why, what will become of Mrs. Lupin, Mark? Apostrophe, Mark looked more fixedly before him, and further off still, as he answered, that he didn't suppose it would be much of an object to her. There were plenty of smart young fellows as would be glad of the place. He knew a dozen himself. That's probable enough, apostrophe said Mr. Pinch, but I am not at all sure that Mrs. Lupin would be glad of them. Why, I always supposed that Mrs. Lupin and you would make a match of it, Mark, and so did everyone, as far as I know. Apostrophe, I never, apostrophe Mark replied, in some confusion, said nothing as was in a direct way courting like to her, nor she to me, but I don't know what I mightn't do one of these odd times, and what she mightn't say in answer. Well, sir, that wouldn't suit. Apostrophe, not to be landlord of the Dragon, Mark? Apostrophe, cried Mr. Pinch. No, sir, certainly not, apostrophe returned the other, withdrawing his gaze from the horizon, and looking at his fellow traveler. Why, that would be the ruin of a man like me. I go and sit down comfortably for life, and no man never finds me out. What would be the credit of the landlord of the dragons being jolly? Why, he couldn't help it, if he tried. Apostrophe, does Mrs. Lupin know you are going to leave her? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Pinchingward. I haven't broke it to her yet, sir, but I must. I'm looking out this morning for something new and suitable, apostrophe, he said, nodding towards the city. What kind of thing now? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Pinch demanded. I was thinking, apostrophe, Mark replied, of something in the grave digging. Way. Apostrophe, good gracious, Mark. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Mr. Pinch. It's a good damp, wormy sort of business, sir, apostrophe, said Mark, shaking his head argumentatively, and there might be some credit in being jolly, with one's mind in that pursuit, unless gravediggers is usually given that way, which would be a drawback. You don't happen to know how that is in general, do you, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, no, apostrophe, said Mr. Pinch, I don't indeed. I never thought upon the subject. Apostrophe, in case of, that not turning out as well as one could wish, you know, apostrophe, said Mark, musing again, there's other businesses. Undertaking now. That's gloomy. There might be credit to be gained there. A broker's man in a poor neighborhood wouldn't be bad, perhaps. A jailer sees a deal of misery. A doctor's man is in the very midst of murder. A bailiff's and a lively office naturally. Even a tax gatherer must find his feelings rather worked upon, at times. There's lots of trades in which I should have an opportunity, I think. Apostrophe, Mr. Pinch was so perfectly overwhelmed by these remarks, that he could do nothing but occasionally exchange a word or two on some indifferent subject, and cast sidelong glances at the bright face of his odd friend, who seemed quite unconscious of his observation, until they reached a certain corner of the road, close upon the outskirts of the city, when Mark said he would jump down there, if he pleased. But bless my soul, Mark, apostrophe, said Mr. Pinch, who in the progress of his observation just then made the discovery that the bosom of his companion's shirt was as much exposed as if it was midsummer and was ruffled by every breath of air, why don't you wear a waistcoat? Apostrophe, apostrophe, what's the good of one, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, asked Mark. Good of one? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Pinch. Why, to keep your chest warm. Apostrophe, Lord love you, sir. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Mark, you don't know me. My chest don't want no warming. Even if it did, what would no waistcoat bring it to? Inflammation of the lungs, perhaps? Well, there'd be some credit in being jolly, with a inflammation of the lungs. Apostrophe, as Mr. Pinch returned no other answer than such as was conveyed in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.